You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2018, as well as the holiday 2018/2019 issues of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Andy's Meal Ticket by Mark Rotzo. For Hopper, it was art's long-awaited return to reality. Actual subject matter, drawn from life. But despite Bloom's unwavering excitement, there were no further sales, and so he got the notion to keep the 32 paintings together as a set. He pitched the idea to Warhol. "If you want to do that, that's wonderful," Warhol told him. Bloom, known for his plummy charm, needed to pour it on in order to persuade the five committed buyers to back off. He prevailed, but not without some agita. The L.A. collector Donald Factor, who claimed to have also chosen Tomato, never forgave him. Bloom admits there was a certain amount of anger through the years, as Warhol asking prices shot into the stratosphere. But, he says, who knew that at the time? Bloom dutifully sent Warhol the agreed-upon 10 monthly installments of $100 to keep the set intact, $1,000 total, $31.25 a painting. They went straight onto the wall of Bloom's Fountain Avenue apartment. He wrote to Warhol saying, "They are a constant source of stimulation and pure pleasure." By keeping them together, Warhol and Bloom had pulled off a kind of checkbook collaboration, and a fateful one. The 32 cans could now be considered a single work, the first example of the seriality and repetition for which Warhol is best known. The artist next moved straight into what DeSalvo calls the bingo moment, using the silkscreen process to actually machine-produce fine art. The iconic Marilyns and Elvises and Jackies. The car crashes and electric chairs. The Campbell soup cans queued that up. They had all the earmarks of what became the Warhol brand. A clear and audacious idea carried out in a clear and audacious way. As writer and visual artist Gary Indiana put it, the Campbell's series condensed, like canned soup, what pop art had been seeking, and also what Warhol had been seeking. Andy was the first artist I ever met who cared about fame, Bingston recalls. He cared more about fame than he did aesthetics or anything else. The soup labels were a logo as much for the artist as for Campbell's. And Warhol would soon become the biggest art celebrity since Picasso. Time magazine gave the cans a shout-out. Warhol gamely posed for photos in a supermarket surrounded by Campbell's. In 1967, the advertising visionary George Lois, a friend of Warhol's, going back to the 50s, booked him for a Braniff Airways commercial. Warhol is seen chattering away to his seatmate. Of course, remember there's an inherent beauty in soup cans that Michelangelo could not have imagined existed. His baffled seatmate is former heavyweight champ Sonny Liston. It wasn't a stretch, then, when Lois, who'd been creating era-defining covers for Esquire, reached out to Warhol again in early 1969. "I called Andy," Lois remembers. "I said, 'Andy, George Lois, I'm going to put you on the cover of Esquire.'" Lois heard a gleeful Warhol shout to the factory crowd, "He's going to put me on the cover of the magazine." Then, A skeptical pause. Wait a minute, George. I know you. What's the idea? I'm going to do a cover of you effing drowning in a can of Campbell's tomato soup. Warhol was ecstatic. Are you going to have to build a giant can of soup? He asked. The classic May 1969 cover, Warhol Sucked into a Vortex of Tomato Soup, is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Andy Warhol being devoured by fame, Lois exclaims. The cover helped fix Warhol forever as the soup guy, for good and bad, the Whitney's Donna DeSalvo says. Campbell's had threatened copyright infringement litigation following the Ferris show, but soon the company was love-bombing Warhol with collegial letters and free soup by the crateful, and in October 1964, commissioned a silk-screened tomato soup can picture from him. In 1967, Campbell's introduced its promotional super dress, a bit of disposable Warhol-inspired pop art. A paper dress, emblazoned with soup cans, offered for $1 plus two labels. If you're lucky enough to find one for sale today, it will run you upwards of $8,000. Over the years, Campbell's had Warhol do paintings of its soup mix boxes, issued limited edition Warhol cans, and adorned the boardroom of its corporate headquarters in Camden, New Jersey, with an original Warhol Campbell's tomato soup can painting, where it still hangs. Warhol helped make Campbell's the American icon it is today, Sarah Rice, the company's corporate archivist, says. We've had a great partnership with the Warhol Foundation. It's the gift that keeps on giving. When you've got a can of Campbell's in your pantry, you feel you've stocked a bit of edible art history. No marketing consultancy could do it better. Bloom didn't know it back then, but he did have the prophetic last laugh when he told the LA Times in 1962 of their importance in the history of art. We shall have to wait and see. For years, he dreamed of forking the lot over to MoMA. It took me a long time to persuade them, Bloom says. By 1996, MoMA curator Kirk Varnadeau had taken an interest and helped push through the combined gift and sale of the 32 Ferris-type Campbell's soup cans to the museum for $15 million. $468,750 a can. MoMA displays the pictures in Bloom's 4x8 grid, as will the Whitney. In 2012, Bloom estimated the combined value at $200 million, which, if anything, was a lowball. Warhol's small torn Campbell's soup can, Pepper Pot, has fetched $11.8 million. 2 years ago, seven screen print versions were lifted from the Springfield Art Museum in Missouri. They remain at large. Seeing the full array of the 1962 cans now, one can't help but consider where we are a half century after the Ferris show. A global marketplace that is largely unapologetic about consumerism. The onward push of branding. Social media's totalizing sizzle of marketing, even in our ostensibly private lives. The consummation of Warhol's alleged prophecy that in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes. My work won't last anyway. I was using cheap paint, Warhol quipped in 1966, daring us, as ever, to take him seriously, or unseriously, at our peril. Yet the soup cans have lasted, and another generation now encounters them. Surely some visitors will see them, among the most familiar images in modern American art, for the first time at the Whitney. Will they seem nihilistic, quaint, campy? Will they provoke dialogue about assimilation, food policy, GMOs? Will they still appear to be about nothing and everything? Does such a cone-like art conundrum now seem dated and contrived? I don't think it'll ever be resolved, DeSalvo says. I think we'll forever be arguing about those soup cans, which is a hallmark of a great work of art. If Andy were alive today and decided to repaint those soup cans, Ruscha says, he would do it in such a way that would be shocking. It's not hard to imagine Warhol doing just that. I should have just done the Campbell's soups and kept on doing them, he once said, because everybody only does one painting anyway. In February 1987, when Andy Warhol left his studio for the last time, keeping an appointment for the operation from which he would never recover, he left behind what was potentially a couple of decades' worth of unfinished work. One artifact propped amid the odds and ends was an enlarged image of a Campbell's soup label, chicken noodle. That variety and tomato are the cans most commonly left as offerings at the artist's grave.
Thank you.
Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Samantha Bee. The Full Frontal with Samantha Bee host talks courage and misinterpretation. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Eternal Christmas Eve in a sparkling clean home with my family, a delicious spread of food, and a bunch of baby animals that require bottle feeding. What is your greatest fear? I can't tell you, or it might come true. What is the trait you most deplore in others? People who lack the courage of their convictions. People who consider it a virtue to avoid paying their fair share. People who cannot summon empathy for others. What is your greatest extravagance? I have consumed so much Topo Chico that my blood is most likely effervescent. What is your favorite journey? Every year we go to Maine, and within 3 minutes of the state line, I have reimagined our entire lives as a family of seafarers. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Civility. We need to worry a lot less about the individual words we choose and a lot more about the incivility of our actions. On what occasion do you lie? To preserve other people's feelings, often to my detriment. Which living person do you most despise? So many great candidates these days. How could I choose just one? Which words or phrases do you most overuse? I overuse the word like when I'm uncomfortable in a conversation, but refuse to punish myself for it. Take it or leave it. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My husband, 17 years married, and I wake up excited to see him every morning. When and where were you happiest? Now, of course. How dare you? Which talent would you most like to have? The talent of being an overall rock star? Isn't that what everyone wants? Okay, I'll settle for plays piano surprisingly well at parties. What is your current state of mind? This questionnaire has put me in a state of distress, and I am eating raw chocolate chip banana muffin dough to carry me through. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I would have a brother or a sister. I sense that it would be nice to have a partner in crime who knew me from the very start. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Getting through this questionnaire without crying. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? Siri. Where would you like to live? I'm lucky enough to live where I would like to live. New York City, baby. What is the quality you most like in a man? A sense of humor. What is the quality you most like in a woman? A sense of humor. Who is your favorite writer? George Saunders. I dream of a world in which we are best friends. Hello, George. Are you reading this? What are your favorite names? Sam and or Samantha. Very versatile. What is it that you most dislike? Being misinterpreted sends me into a state of complete agitation. It wakes me up at night. How would you like to die? I'd like to be very old, but still with it, hanging around with my family and instantly crushed by a fallen piece of space shuttle. No one else is hurt in the accident. What is your motto? Think before you agree to press request. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Samantha Bee. And that concludes the December 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. Now we move on to the holiday 2018/2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Lin-Manuel Miranda on the cover. Vanity Fair agenda, promotion, events. Event, Stars Honor America to Me. Vanity Fair and Stars collaborated for a celebration honoring the Stars original series America to Me, ahead of a special screening at the L.A. Film Festival, which was part of Participant Media's 10-City Social Impact Campaign rollout. Guests included series subjects, industry notables, along with students and teachers from the Los Angeles Unified School District. The poignant series follows students, teachers, and administrators in suburban Chicago's Oak Park and River Forest High School, one of the country's most exemplary and diverse public schools, over the course of a year as they grapple with decades-long racial and educational inequities. Following the screening, Vanity Fair's West Coast editor Krista Smith moderated a compelling Q&A between director Steve James, series subjects Jess Stovall and Kishon Kumsa, LAUSD board member Nick Melvoin, and LAUSD teacher Joel Laguna. Discover John Hardy's Sintinaga Trilogy. Originally a private coterie of singular masterpieces designed around a unique gem, the Cinti collection has been unified into the first high jewelry collection under creative director Holly Bonneville Barden. Named after the Balinese word for love, Cinti is inspired by the raw power of nature. The three-part collection is available online for the first time, featuring 15 unique designs celebrating the essence of Naga and its elemental universes. Volcano, sky, and ocean. Drink, celebrate with Blue Label, a special Scotch whiskey for special moments. Give the gift of luxury with Johnny Walker Blue Label. Only one in every 10,000 cask has the elusive quality, character, and flavor to deliver the remarkable signature taste of Johnny Walker Blue Label. Celebrate the holidays with the ultimate gift to give. Available with custom engraving. Here are some of the contributors to this month's issue. Marie Brenner, the mogul who came in from the cold. Bill Browder's ferocious campaign against Vladimir Putin is the stuff of spy thrillers, says the Vanity Fair writer-at-large. Her 2012 article, Marie Colvin's Private War, was adapted into the recently released film A Private War, starring Rosamund Pike as the late war reporter Marie Colvin. The 2018 Hall of Fame, Robert Redford on Bob Woodward. A director, producer, and Oscar-winning actor, Redford is also a founder of the Sundance Film Festival. Jacqueline Woodson on Naomi Wadler. A best-selling author and poet, Woodson is currently serving as the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Mariska Hargitay on Judge Aquilina. Hargitay's work on Law and Order, Special Victims Unit, has earned her both a Golden Globe and an Emmy Award. Monica Lewinsky on Hannah Gadsby. The Vanity Fair contributing editor is an activist and an ambassador to Bystander Revolution, an anti-bullying organization. Dave Eggers on Kylian Mbappé. The author of Heroes of the Frontier, Eggers founded McSweeney's and co-founded the literacy project 826 Valencia. Dee Rees on Ryan Coogler. Rees directed last year's Mudbound, earning her an Oscar nod for Best Adapted Screenplay. Christopher Buckley on Stormy Daniels. The celebrated political satirist is the author, most recently, of The Judge Hunter. Katherine Johnson on Stephen Hawking. As a NASA mathematician, Johnson helped launch the U.S.'s first successful manned spaceflights. Ethan James Green and Julia Wagner. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious-Lin-Manuel Miranda. When shooting this month's cover star, Green, a photographer, and Wagner, a set designer, channeled the whimsy and magic of the theater, a setting Miranda knows well, and playfully opted to make the Mary Poppins Returns star's harness and strings visible in the final photos. Lily Annalick, Starburst, the Vanity Fair contributor, whose book on Eve Babbitt's Hollywood's Eve will be published by Scribner on January 8th, remembers Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton, and Britney Spears at their peak. When one of those three made a movie, I was watching, she says. I knew it was a golden age, even then. Now for the editor's letter from Radhika Jones. In the photo, Annie Leibovitz photographs Stormy Daniels in West Grove, Pennsylvania. And they are both photographed here at a horse farm. The Vanity Fair Hall of Fame dates back to the magazine's original incarnation in the 1910s. It was a monthly feature that shone a spotlight on artists, writers, society figures, and other luminaries whom the editors felt worthy of recognition. The first installment, published in December 1913, included Anna Pavlova, the greatest dancer of the age. Rodin, to see him at work in his atelier is to see not merely art, but life itself in the making. And Arnold Henry Savage Landor, the first European traveler to enter the forbidden city of Tibet. We like to think that the news moves more quickly than ever now, but that's just the hubris of presentism. It would be hard to win that argument with a reader during, say, World War II, or the Civil Rights Movement, or Watergate. That said, the year's end is an opportune moment to reflect on some of the people who rose up and made themselves heard amid the din. So we have revived the Vanity Fair Hall of Fame portfolio, last seen in these pages in December 2003, shot by our own Annie Leibovitz, who traveled from coast to coast and across the Atlantic to situate newsmakers in their environments. One of the first pictures Annie made for the portfolio was of Stormy Daniels, porn star and presidential foe, whose entanglements with Donald Trump, back when he was just a guy firing people on television, have caused, among other things, his one-time personal lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, to attest that Cohen paid her off at Trump's direction, which could well be a crime. Jousting with the president on Twitter is no doubt tiring, even for someone as good at it as Daniels, so Annie wanted to photograph her in the place where she goes to get away from it all. As the two of them talked, Annie learned that Daniels loves riding horses. She competes, she shows, she's a very serious equestrian, Annie told me. No one really knows who she is in the horse world, so I said, I would love to photograph you riding. They met on July 31st in West Grove, Pennsylvania, where Daniels boards a couple of her horses. It's transformative for her to ride, Annie says. She gets lost in that world. Only one of the portraits in the 2018 Hall of Fame dates earlier than this year, and that is a never-before-seen picture of Stephen Hawking. Annie photographed him on January 23, 2017, at his home in Cambridge, England. Present at the shoot were Hawking's assistant, Anthea Bain, his housekeeper, Diana Briscoe, and his son, Tim. Annie recalls that they told her he looked like a little boy when he was lying in bed, that he looked most like himself. Hawking died in March of 2018, and at the end of his life, he wrote eloquently about the need for human beings to colonize other planets. Not for the gratification that comes with exploration, but because we have treated our own planet with such reckless indifference that we can reasonably expect its annihilation. Through his work, the clarity of his ideas, and the grace of his very being, Hawking was a bearer of light. As this year closes, we remember his words as a call to action, to stop the indifference, and to honor the fragile, glorious beauty all around us. The Trimmings, the Vanity Fair gift guide, let the cultural highlights of the holiday season inspire your gift-giving, from Art Basel in Miami to the return of Mrs. Maisel to opening nights of Broadway and the opera. A compendium of event-themed cues will help you fill packages of every size with delightful surprises. Opening Photograph by Grant Cornett. Deck Your Neck, Bulgari High Jewelry Necklace. And This Is Diamonds and Blue Topaz. For the free-spirited songbird, a luxe new coffee table book by rock and roll photographer Norman Seif, Joni, The Joni Mitchell Sessions, published by Insight Editions, features intimate portraits of the beloved bohemian chanteuse who just rang in her 75th. For the beach-bound gallery hopper, cultural sprawl hits Miami Beach with the opening of Art Basel, one of the biggest contemporary art fairs in the U.S., featuring 268 top galleries. 29 are new this year for a week of creative virtue and vice. And this gift-giving guide shows everything from swimsuits to roller skates, purses to a Polaroid camera. For the manner-born feminist, Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie star as rival rulers, sometime friends, and extravagant collar enthusiast in Mary, Queen of Scots, which follows their feud from the wilds of Scotland to the opulent Elizabethan court. And this gift-giving guide shows bird feeders, fancy gowns, beautiful necklaces, shoes, makeup, and candelabra. For the natty news junkie, Bryan Cranston returns to Broadway in Network, a stage adaptation of the 1976 film that feels hauntingly relevant today. Cranston plays an unraveling news anchor who delivers the famous battle cry, "I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore." And this gift-giving guide shows ice buckets, plaid loafers, trench coats, the book, Good and Mad, suits, fancy watches, and garment bags. For the gala-going romantic, Giuseppe Verdi's scandalous opera La Traviata, which translates to The Woman Led Astray, and served as the influence for both Pretty Woman and Moulin Rouge, returns to New York's Metropolitan Opera in a dazzling new production. And this gift guide shows fancy shoes, a beautiful long dress, a luxurious tuxedo, opera glasses, and fancy jewelry. For the cleverest mama, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the ebullient Emmy-winning series about a mid-century housewife turned stand-up comic, returns for a second season, picking up 1 year later with its bright and bold take on female empowerment. And this gift-giving guide shows a Dutch oven pot, rattles for the babies, a beautiful raincoat, shoes, pajamas, gloves, and a gold bracelet. More from the Vanity Fair agenda, promotion, events. Shop. Richard Mille opens New York City flagship. Swiss watch manufacturer Richard Mille opened its largest boutique in the world this fall in New York City. Located at 46 East 57th Street, the 4,200-square-foot flagship becomes the ninth Richard Mille boutique in the Americas. A two-story oasis of sleek contemporary design, bathed in abundant natural light, the boutique represents a new architectural standard for the luxury brand. The extreme technicity and artistry that defines Richard Mille timepieces is also evident in every element of the boutique, starting with the 30-foot-high glass facade that is illuminated by 156 feet of LED lights. A glowing presence at the foundation of the tallest residential tower in the Western Hemisphere. Shop rock star treatment without leaving home. We've long been able to get clothes custom fit to exact measurements, and now you can have perfect fit with your earbuds, too. Ultimate Ears, famous for creating custom in-ear monitors for pop touring musicians, is now making custom earbuds for everyone. With customized fit, unmatched sound clarity, and interchangeable Bluetooth and aux connectivity, you will experience music like never before. Design your earbuds online, receive Ultimate Ears' proprietary fit kit by mail, and experience their white glove bespoke fit process in the comfort of your own home. Your set is then handcrafted in California, and you receive them about a week later. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.